Yes, Move and California Man. It's 12 minutes past two, and California Man is very, very appropriate because in the studio with us, welcome Bill Bristow. Bill, you are now living in Bembridge, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yes.
And welcome to Vectis Radio. But California Man, about 30 years ago, you were working in the film industry in California, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was there for 9 years.
And that's and you have actually, you learnt filmmaking and you got your degree in California, didn't you?
Yes, I did, yeah.
So, please tell us about that, because you've got so many different things that you've done over your life. Filmmaking is only one of them, and I know you're still filmmaking.
Yes.
But when you were out there, you were doing movies, weren't you? And
I was doing behind the scenes mainly, and documentaries.
When you say behind the scenes, was it those kind of things that you'll always get on a DVD where people do sort of making of
the making
documentaries?
Of, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
You must have met some incredible people while you were out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, well, I don't want to sort of name drop, but I worked a long, long time with Rutger Hauer, who's still a very good friend of mine.
Yeah, now
Blade Runner.
Yes, I know. I mean, he was the sort of evil, Germanic-looking baddie in Blade Runner, and that is his sort of signature role, isn't it?
Yes.
And I know you've been. He does acting and film schools, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Yeah.
And do you work with him on those now, don't you?
I did. Yeah, and I do. Oh, well, I don't anymore because the film festival that he set up in Milan, along with Ridley Scott. Was part of that for a while, and Robert Rodriguez, and we used to sit, and it was a virtual judging panel.
Wow.
So we used to get about 300 to 400 short films that we had to look through and score.
Yeah.
And then we'd all compare notes, and then we'd decide who was going to get an award and who wasn't.
Right.
And I did that for about 4 years.
But yeah,
then
that must be fun.
Due to EU and financial the financial collapse of so many things, Milan couldn't help fund it any longer,
right.
And Smart Cars, that were a big funder, couldn't do it any longer, and so it's they're thinking of getting it going again, but it won't happen for a while because of the state of things.
But you're still in the film industry, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I don't know if you want to know, but it's a very strange way that I got into the film industry. I used to have a headhunting business in the City of London.
Right.
And we'd been doing it for about 4 or 5 years, and we were one of the first, and we were making very silly money for our age.
Yeah.
And my partner had a friend who wanted to do a film for BAFTA.
Right.
So we put up half the money, and his father put up the other half of the money. We made the film, and I acted one of the main roles in it. And I then said, right, that's it. I want to go to Hollywood.
As you do.
As you do. So we closed down the offices, packed our bags, and went off. And I then decided, I worked on...
how on earth did you have the balls to do that, if you don't mind me saying the word balls?
I don't know. I didn't really think about it. It was just something I wanted to do.
I suppose when you're young, you don't really sort of think about the repercussions, do you?
And, I mean, from a financial point of view, we had enough money to be over there for about 6 months without having to worry too much. And then I got the job of working as Rutger's stand-in on The Hitcher. And when I'd finished that, I thought, I better go to film school to learn how this is done properly. So I then went to film school and ended up doing a documentary which Whoopi Goldberg helped finance with HBO.
Oh, amazing.
And I was part of the Hands Across America, which was the whole thing about homeless people.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember there's a story about you sort of got a bit disillusioned, didn't you, with the industry out there. And there's a buffet which particularly made you disillusioned, wasn't there?
You're right. I was working on an American Express commercial.
Yeah.
In the city of Los Angeles, which is where all the stockbroking and stuff goes.
Yeah.
And they produced all this food in a park, which was in the middle of all this quadrangle.
Yeah.
Where there's sort of Merrill Lynch and Shearson Loeb Roads and the Bank of America. Because we were using those as part of the American Express backdrop.
Yeah.
And all this food came out, and the homeless people came along. And the guy who was the production manager and the director said, they were asking for some food, and mm-hmm. they said, no, go away, I'm going to give this to my dogs.
Yeah. Oh.
So I then called up, because Dennis Weaver, who had done Duel and a few other, that old, he was a detective on a horse.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember
that. I remember, with the droopy moustache.
That's right, yeah. And he set up this thing to go around to film sets to collect food to take to food banks for homeless people. So I called him up and said, by the way, and about half an hour later, a truck arrived and went up to the production manager and the director and said, we're taking your food.
Good for you.
So it went.
But I understand that you know, the director looked very magnanimous with Dennis Weaver, but I think you weren't very popular, were you?
No, I wasn't. I didn't work with him again.
Now, I think we'll listen to your first track now, which is Rolling Stones' Satisfaction. Can we come back to the film industry and sort of what you did after that? And obviously, all that sort of work you were doing on sort of advertising came in very useful when you were in Spain.
Yes,
because
it did.
I know you did a lot of work with all the major car companies with their advertising campaigns.
Yes.
Perhaps we can talk about that, and then also about your current production company.
Well, yeah, just before you start Satisfaction, again, name-dropping, we were working on a film in Australia, and I was doing the behind the scenes, the making of. And the publicity girl also was working for Mick Jagger when he was doing his solo tour around Australia.
Oh, right.
So we got invited to his birthday party.
Oh, how wonderful.
And I was standing in line, and there was Lou Gossett Jr., Joan Chen, who was a very famous Chinese actress, there was Rutger Hauer, and before Lou Gossett Jr., there was an Australian actor whose name I've forgotten now, who was in the original Mad Max.
Yeah.
And so when Mick arrives, he's introduced to all of us.
Yeah.
And he's looking at Rutger, and he goes to me and he says, who's that?
Yeah.
And I say, and I do the thumb thing with the thumbs in the eyeballs from Blade Runner.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I go, Blade Runner. He goes, oh, right. And he said, who are you? And I said, well, I'm no one, mate. I'm just a cameraman. To which he laughed and he said, that's great, I'm a good time.
I'm surprised Mick Jagger didn't say King Lear.
Yeah, right,
yeah. No. Satisfaction.
I tried.
The Rolling Stones, of course, and Satisfaction. It's 23 minutes past two. We're very lucky to have Bill Bristow from Benbridge with us in the studio today. And Bill, we've just been talking about your work out in Hollywood, which sounds very glamorous, but as you said, you became a little bit dejected with it in the end. You actually then moved to Spain.
Yes, I did.
And what sounds like a very glamorous job there, because what you were doing was, I think, doing advertising campaigns for a lot of the major car companies, finding the right places in Europe for them to actually film advertisements and promotional campaigns. Tell us about that.
Well, just before you go any further, that song just reminds me of when I was about 8 years old, strumming an old Slazenger tennis racket.
Well, it's
pretending I was Keith Richards.
It's better than an air guitar, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Except it, you
at
know,
least there's some strings.
Yeah, there were some strings. Just didn't sound quite right.
Yeah, we've all done that. I mean, I remember. Do you remember the $6 Million Man?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I bought myself a white denim outfit with a red shirt so I could look like him. So I was this podgy 10-year-old wandering around in white jeans and a sort of red Airtex T-shirt so I could look like the $6 Million Man. It's terrible, isn't it, when you think back to all those things? Yeah.
I mean, the reason I moved to Spain was to write a book with my father about my father before he died, essentially.
Yes.
Because he was great friends with Kim Philby and was MI6 and knew Peter Wright, who'd written Spycatcher, and I didn't really know who he was. I mean, at the age of 10, I thought he was a traitor. I thought he'd been working for the Germans or whatever, because there was all this talk of Philby. But to go back to Spain, and advertising, after I'd finished the book, I didn't really quite know what to do, and some friends who I'd met in LA for a company called Chiat Day said, why don't you set up a location stroke production company for advertising? And I did, and very, very quickly I was doing stuff for sort of Ford and Land Rover, and mostly for Nissan. I mean, I ended up being called the Nissan man because I was all over Morocco.
Was it a cash cow?
It was good, absolutely. It certainly was. It's very, very hard work. It was, you know, 7 days a week, 15, 18 hours a day, non-stop.
And I can imagine, you know, people do think, you know, looking for a location must be glamorous, but, must be putting in a lot of miles.
Yes.
Just trying to find these right places.
Often going without lunch because you don't know if you're going to get there before the sun goes down sort of stuff.
Do you look at adverts now and think, you know, because a lot of adverts use drones now, of course, for these shots.
Mm.
You know, if you'd had that technology then, it could have been done for a fraction of the price, couldn't it?
I
guess you had to use helicopters in those days.
Well, helicopters, yes. And also, for a lot of stuff, they'd have these rigs that you put onto the car, or the car was put on, so you then had to get roadblocks, and you had to get this, because all of a sudden what was a normal car was taking up the whole road, not just one lane.
Yeah.
And I can remember a funny time in Valencia, actually, and we were on a bridge. And we had this rig which was sticking right out, so there was literally two lanes of traffic on essentially a four-lane bridge.
Wow.
And rush hour came up, and we'd got friendly with the police, and it was a Friday afternoon. And you heard over the radio that there was something like a 4 kilometer backup of traffic for people wanting to go to this area.
Yeah.
So I went to the police and he said, no, they're only going to go and buy beer and most probably look for prostitutes and go to the disco. They can wait. We were there way longer than I wanted
that's
to be.
That's a Spanish damned in that terrible... Now, I want to ask you more about your father in a few minutes, because there are these two books we can talk about. But just before that, wind forward to the present. You're in Benbridge. What brought you to Benbridge?
A friend of mine called Mark Wilkinson, who's a cameraman.
Yeah.
He does a lot of camera work for, or used to, for a lot of, The Who and bands, basically. And in Spain, things were starting to, you know, the crisis was coming up.
Yeah.
Work was dying because everything was going to South Africa. Mm-hmm. And got a son who I thought, well, do I want to carry him being educated here? Or rather, he was educated in the UK.
Yeah.
Mark said, come and have a look at the Isle of Wight. And I went, yeah, this is a really nice place,
yeah.
Especially for a kid.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Very
and,
safe. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I moved here and stayed here. Moved here in, what, 2009?
Yep.
And have stayed here. And
but you've really dived into local life, haven't you? Because you know, you're a local councillor,
yeah,
in Bembridge, and it's right that at Northwood House you're head of marketing. Is that right?
I was.
Okay, fine.
I had to give that one up because I then became a trustee of the local youth community centre in Bembridge, and and sort of other things as well, and work. I mean, I'm starting to, well, been working on producing a film now for about 2 years and raising the money, and the work element was just, I couldn't do as much
now
locally.
This film is about a bookshop, isn't it?
Yes, a used bookshop.
Yeah, and yeah. You've got John Cleese lined up for that, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and Simon Callow.
Simon Callow, yeah.
Stacey Keach, I don't know if you remember
him. No, I don't
him.
Know her.
Him.
Him, oh.
American actor.
Why do American actors and actresses always have interchangeable
yeah,
names?
Robin,
it's like the word Taylor. Taylor, it just drives me mad.
Yeah. Alex, you know. Is Alex Rose a girl or a boy? Well, that's debatable.
When's that coming out?
Well, we're still searching for money.
Yeah.
We've just had an executive producer join us called Steve Squalante, who has got loads of experience. He did a lot of the Transporter films for Iron Global with the English actor whose name I've forgotten. So that's really helped us a lot. We're talking with Netflix at the moment.
Brilliant.
We're in
yeah.
the middle of Cannes, so that conversation's on hold until Cannes.
So that's where the money is coming from, isn't it, at the moment? Netflix and Amazon.
Netflix, Amazon. You've now got BBC, who are forming something called Vroom, and I think Richard Branson's going to start something of a similar type for Virgin. There's mm-hmm. talks about that. Because at the end of the day, you know, with the size of your screens inside your house mm. and the sound systems mm. that you get, it's you know, and then you go to the cinema, and if you're at the back of the cinema, the screen in your Cineplex isn't actually much bigger than the screen in your sitting room.
Yeah, exactly. No, well, we run the sort of pop-up cinema in Bembridge. And,
oh, do you?
Yeah, and you know, we've got the
yeah,
we watch it at home, and it's much bigger than going to Cineworld.
Excuse me.
So. Anyway, look, let's talk about your father after
yes.
the ads. I think we've got Who Are You on immediately after the ads.
Yeah, I'm never sure who I am.
Well, you're a man of many parts. We'll be back with you, Bill Preston, in just a few minutes. Thank you.
The House of Chili is located at Hollier's Barn in Branston, between Princelet Shoot and Thompson Garden Centre. We stock a vast array of chili-related products from the Isle of Wight. Chili balsamics, relishes, chutneys, marmalades, sweets, snacks, dried mixes, and a vast array of hot sauces from the Isle of Wight and around the world. We have sample tables to taste a wide variety of products. Looking for that unique present? How about a House of Chili gift pack or one of our luxury hampers? Check out www.houseofchili.com. Ideal gifts for the chili lover in your life.
Having problems with your phone? Or are your electrics on the blink? Maybe you need your appliances or your building wiring tested. Or just a light fitted. West Wight Audio and Electrical Services can help you. For friendly, reliable service, call Kelvin on 754666 or click westwhiteaudio.co.uk. All island coverage.
Kiartz's Youth Up for Waves is offering another popular pottery workshop with Claire Robinson on Saturday 25th of June from 10 a.m. till 2:30 p.m, where young people aged 11 to 19 can have the opportunity to spend a fun day in our pottery studio. Your work will be fired and glazed and ready to collect 2 weeks after the workshop. It is really easy to book your place. Simply call Kiartz's box office on 822 490. Waves is a Kiartz's Youth offer, funded by the Isle of Wight Council and available to young people resident to the Isle of Wight.
Hi, I'm Kevin Wilson. Join me every Monday from 1 till 4 for my personal take on the news, plus a special guest, lots of info on the island's arts and entertainment scene. See you on Monday. Best day of the week.
Stay social and get in touch. It's at Vectis Radio on Twitter. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
I'm walking on sunshine. Whoa. And You're walking on sunshine with Vectis Radio.
Putting the community back into local radio. This is Vectis Radio.
VectisRadio.com.
For the people, by the people.
22 minutes to 3. It's the afternoon show with James and Judy here on Vectis Radio. Bill Bristow's in the studio with us. We've just been talking about all of his work on films and over in Spain doing commercials and promotional campaigns for car companies. But, Bill, I'd like to talk now about your father, because you've written two books, one with your father, A Game of Moles, and the other, which is here, My Father the Spy, which pretty much gives the away the game, doesn't it? You found out at some point that your father wasn't who he said he was.
Yeah. Just to repeat what I was just saying to you, you know, when I was at school and all the other kids were saying, you know, Dad was in this during the Second World War, and I didn't have any idea at all. And then there were conversations at dinner parties and you know, when friends came over about his friend Kim Philby having gone to Russia, which is when I was about 8. And, you know, yeah, your good friend, what would you do? You know, he's a double agent. He's been working for the Russians. And I sort of overhear this conversation. I was thinking, really? How come Pa was a friend of his?
Yeah.
So then I sort of went back to school. And then when I was about 9 and a half, 10, Pa went off to, off to South Africa. Because at that time he was working for De Beers on helping sort out smuggling rackets.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I went rifling through his wardrobe, and I then found a British intelligence officer's uniform with major, whatever it is, insignia on it.
Yeah.
And then I found a German Luger with two rounds of live ammunition.
How scary. Oh, blimey.
And a holster, and then I found German cat comforters, and then I found German sunglasses, and a couple of German medals. And I thought, crikey, Pa's friend was a traitor. So when he came back, I plucked up the courage and went downstairs, and he was in the study, and I...
How old were you?
10.
Oh gosh, you were courageous.
I put the gun on the table, and I said, were you a traitor?
Wow.
And he laughed. Of course not.
At least you weren't horsewhipped.
No, Pa wasn't like that at all. He was a very funny chap. And I, of course, burst into tears and went running back upstairs. And my mother, who was quite good at swearing, was swearing like hell at him, saying, you got to tell him, da-da-da-da-da. Anyway, he came upstairs and said, look, I'm really sorry. No, I wasn't a traitor. And yes, you might have heard. And over a period of about 6 to 8 months, it sort of came out that he'd been working as British intelligence, as he called it. And then as time progressed, I realized it was MI6 and that he'd been working in Spain with my... Because I'm a lot younger than the others, but my two sisters and my brother were brought up in Spain when he was the head of MI6 in Spain and the whole Mediterranean area.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so my sister, who she didn't really know either, she just, you know, they were brought up in a fairly, you know, chauffeurs and butlers and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So then by the time I was about 16, 17 and rebelling from school, and I was then asked to leave school, so I ended up finishing my A-levels in London.
Right.
And Pa was working in London, so I got to spend more time with him and started to really prod. And he started to say, I was friends. And by the way, Tommy Harris, your godfather, was also MI5, and he was the man who was the case officer that handled all Garbo, which were the D-Day deceptions.
Gosh.
And Ken Mills, who was my other godfather, was MI5 and had worked with Pa at De Beers sorting out the smuggling racket.
Wow.
And so it's like, I was brought up in a household of spies. This is why I have a rather cynical attitude towards politics. never realizing, but always sort of...
But most teenagers would say, whatever, wouldn't they? So you spy, whatever. But you didn't.
No, I didn't. No. I wanted to know who he was. So then when I was in America and I'd written a couple of unsuccessful screenplays, and I'd written a few bits and pieces for a magazine called Venice Magazine from my travels around doing behind-the-scenes videos or makings of.
Yeah.
The writer who was going to write his book... A Game of Moles had to go, Ian McGurk, who is an independent journalist, had to go to India.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I'll come back and write the book with you. And I wrote up a five-page example to the publishers, which was Little Brown and Alan Sampson, who was the publisher. He said, yeah, great. That's terrific. Go ahead. Because I included all Pa's childhood, because the reason he got into it was because he was brought up in Spain, fluent Spanish speaker, mm-hmm. Spoke French fluently as well.
Yeah.
And he'd been travelling through Spain to go to school from because Grandpa had two copper mines in Spain, and right. So Pa was at school in Dulwich in London.
Yeah.
So he used to travel a lot.
Yeah.
And the mine area was where there was a bit of Spanish Civil War fighting. Mm. But Pa had seen a lot of the German 9mm anti-tank guns, which were... And he was then asked to give lectures about the German guns that were in Spain. When he escaped from Spain, they wouldn't allow him to get out.
Gosh.
Jumped on a train, came to London. When he got to London, he went to the War Office and said, "I want to join up." And they said, "We haven't got any space." So he drove tractors and stuff around Oxford and Cambridge and did a bit of rowing at Cambridge.
Yeah.
And then eventually he joined up and was in the infantry. And then in the infantry, he was recruited into intelligence. And then from the intelligence, he was interviewed by Philby.
Yeah.
And became MI6 in the Iberian section. And he was instrumental in helping Charles de Gaulle become the sort of leader of the Free French and therefore the president of France.
Wow.
And
there was
involved in a cover-up of an assassination.
The assassination of Admiral Darlan,
that's
I
right,
believe.
Yes,
and
yes.
Admiral Darlan, of course, was on the wrong side of the war, wasn't he?
That's right. Yeah.
He was the admiral who went to the Vichy side.
And Pa's cover story to all his mates in Gibraltar was... He was getting Christmas turkeys.
Because I think Admiral Darlan was sort of mistakenly believed that he could control North Africa.
Yes, and help the Germans a lot.
Yeah, exactly, but
it
didn't happen.
And give the French fleet to the Germans, which is why, you know, it was ordered for the French fleet to be destroyed in Iran, in Algiers.
Now, the book you did with your father, you wrote this in Spain, I think, with him.
Yes, that's right.
And it caused a bit of a sensation at the time, didn't it? Because the UK government wasn't too pleased in the weight of the sort of Spycatcher book. They were sort of very, very upset.
Yes,
but
they were.
You published in Spain, didn't you?
In Spanish.
In Spanish. And then 3 days later, it was in the public domain. This all sounds very... Very much
deceptive.
Like the kind of things that are happening on Twitter at the moment,
yeah.
Isn't it? 3 days later, of course, it was published.
Yes, that's right.
By Little Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
But not too many secrets in there, because I understand.
No.
One of the reviewers at the time said, you know, there was about as much revealed as a sort of White House Whitehall menu.
That's right.
Card or something like that.
Yeah.
But because, you know, your father was simply telling the truth.
Yes.
About what was going on.
And not telling everything.
And not telling everything, yeah. But there's a fascinating book. Why did he choose to write another one?
Was me.
Well, because the first one was you with your father.
Yeah.
And that's an autobiography. The next one, which is out and you can buy on Amazon.
Yes.
It's called My Father the Spy, Deceptions of an MI6 Officer, by you. Is that more about the personal story of you discovering what your father
did? It's more about the personal story, but it's also because I did find a load of notes that he was possibly thinking of putting in the book that we wrote together.
Oh, I see.
Which he hadn't, which is when I found out that he was involved in the cover-up of... the assassination of Admiral Darlan and
so this takes it forward a lot.
Yeah, and how he'd spent quite a lot of time with Otto Skorzeny, who was the German SS officer Odessa was
I
was trying to think of.
You kindly brought in a newspaper article, and I don't know whether people at home have sort of seen this recently. This is one from Daily Mail on March the 31st this year, but it was in all the papers, wasn't it?
Mm.
This guy, who was a professional assassin for Hitler,
yes.
Seemed particularly strangely to have been hired later by Mossad.
That's right.
To work as an assassin for them. And looking at a picture of him, I'm struck by two things. Firstly, with that scar on his face, he really does look like an assassin. Secondly, Judy, don't you think he looks like the young pictures of my dad?
He does a bit.
That's the one thing. Yeah. He looks really, really, really like my dad did.
Yeah.
So, perhaps there's a story for me to find out.
He was a duelist, which is how he got the scars.
Really? Yes. Yeah. I mean, he really does look a very, very
evil
guy.
And he was very big.
So, how did your dad know him?
Well, the CIA and the FBI, and he was great friends with Al Imer, who was the head of the CIA, and a chap called Philip. Oh, I can't remember the FBI guy, whose name I will get in a minute, needed to find out information on Skorzeny, because Skorzeny was the guy who essentially was running the Odessa file of shifting money out of Germany, or Nazi Germany, into South America and other places as well. And he was spending a lot of time going to America as well. And the Americans didn't want it to be obvious to Skorzeny that they were watching him. So they asked Parr, you know, would you mind? He goes to this place for coffee a lot and just kick up a conversation. So he did. And over a period of about 6 to 8 months, you know, Skorzeny would be there and suddenly he'd be off and he'd come back again. And he'd even made a trip to Israel in like 1953 at that time. Even though he was on the wanted list by the Jewish, you know, the Jewish committee that were out searching for war criminals. And Pa sort of kicked up a relationship with him. My Pa is like 5'10", and this guy is 6'3". Quite, you know, he's a big man. But he found out, yes, he was shifting money over to America and, in fact, was giving money to George Bush's grandfather, the last Bush president, grandfather, to help finance a lot of right-wing elements in America.
How extraordinary.
At that time. So that was stuff that he didn't put in the book, but is notes. Yeah, yeah.
And your book is sort of full of... lots of interesting spy stories. Thank you very much for bringing a copy in today. If people want to get that at home, I know it's on Amazon, isn't it?
Yes, it's
called,
is. Yeah.
My Father the Spy, Deceptions of an MI6 Officer by Bill Bristow. Bill, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up at this point. It's been absolutely fascinating having you in the studio. You've got loads of stories to tell. And any more books in the pipeline?
No, not at the moment.
But there are films, so we're going to look out for those.
Hopefully.
And it's possible... you said that this book about your father could be turned into a film itself.
Yes, or a TV series, hopefully.
Well, fabulous. Well, look forward to that. Thank you ever so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
See you again soon.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Bye.